The date is August 24th, 2007, and we're at the Atlantic Coast Bank in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veteran History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing William Calvin Burke, who was born on January 30th, 1943, in Milford, Delaware. My name is Frank Reitinger, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Bill Birdsong, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Okay, Bill, just take it and do it.
Okay. I graduated in June of 1961 from Milford High School. The day after I graduated, my dad gave me 60 days to get out of the house. 25 days later, I had a chat with a Navy recruiter and told him I had to get the hell out of Dodge. And he said, you in trouble with the law? And I said, no. He said, well, talk to me. So I did. So when I was done talking to him, he said, son, we can do business. And I looked at him and said, no shit, get your paperwork. I was the fastest recruit he ever had. However, as soon as I took my physical in Dover, it looked like I may not get in the United States Navy. 2 years prior, as a member of a wrestling team, on the third night of practice, my shoulder got broken in three places, and I needed surgery and a pin installed, and that pin was later removed, but I wound up with a nasty scar on my right shoulder. As soon as the Medi guys up in the Navy recruit center saw this in Dover, they all freaked, and I got an appointment with an orthopedic surgeon up in Philadelphia Navy Yard. The upshot of that interview was I did a bunch of exercises that he wanted me to do, and this guy wound up sitting behind his oak desk. He was a lieutenant commander wearing the gold oak leaves, and he was sitting behind his desk and did not want to make a decision. I decided I had to get in the Navy. I had to leave home, so I told him, would it prove anything if I cold-cocked him and knocked him on his butt? Would that prove my arm was good enough? He looked at me, and I could see the wheels turning. He smiled 5 seconds later and said, son, anybody that wants it that bad deserves it. And he signed off, and I was now going to be in the United States Navy. Here's the trick. It was one of the best poker bluffs I ever pulled in my life. We were talking about my right arm and right shoulder. I'm left-handed. He was going to get cold-cocked, but not with the right hand. I left Philadelphia on July 25th and took my first airline flight aboard a piston engine DC-6 and wound up at boot camp about midnight. The next morning, the confusion and hell began. Within hours, we all were divided into companies. We all got our hairs cut. We had uniforms that stank thrown at us. And then we're informed, as we were broken into companies, we thought we had just joined the Navy. No, no, no. We were not sailors. We were the worst pieces of crap in human existence. We were no longer civilians, and we sure weren't sailors. And this was made very clear to us. Here's a point I'd like to make. Who were my boot camp commanders, the chiefs and the commanders in 1961? Do a little history research. These guys were the survivors of World War II in Korea. They didn't take prisoners. And we were all volunteers, so they didn't care how many I got rid of. My company started out with 80 guys in it. In October, 13 weeks later, when we graduated, there was 53 of us left. I happened to be one of them. Boot camp experiences. Boot camp is a pain in the ass and hell, and none of us liked it. We knew that the barbed wire on the top was facing in to keep us in, not the bad guys out. However, I have three little short stories where I actually had fun in boot camp. Believe it or not, I actually had fun. Story number one, about 4 to 6 weeks in, we went swimming at an Olympic-sized pool in a big hangar. I did not realize how many village idiots joined the United States Navy and couldn't swim. About half of my company couldn't swim. We were supposed to jump off a tower, jump straight feet in, and hands crossed the chest, so if you evacuated a ship, you wouldn't hit debris down below. I couldn't resist. My company commander turned his back. I dove in. I'd learned to swim when I was a kid in Delaware for years and years. So I dove in. When I surfaced, He was calling me everything but a white child because he had seen my feet in the water and knew I dove. I thereupon swam around the pool, had a great time, and helped rescue a few of my fellow company members who were trying to do a drowning exercise and pulled them out, and in generally had a great time. I went swimming. I hadn't been swimming in like 6-8 weeks, and it was a blast. That's story number one. Story number two. 2 weeks or so later, we had this obstacle course we had to do. What it basically amounted to was two towers and about a 2-inch rope, and 2-inch diameter rope across about 60 feet long across this huge pit of mud and water about 4 feet deep. The first guy across was a big, hefty black guy who had muscles the size of my thighs. This guy pumped iron, and there was no doubt he was strong. He got halfway across the rope, but when he started going back uphill, he lost it and wound up in the mud. Whereupon our line stopped. Nobody would cross this rope because nobody wanted to wind up chest deep in mud and water with their boondockers under this mud and water and be clean for the next day's inspection. Nobody wanted to do this. Finally, after about 5 minutes of stalling and the chief screaming at us, I volunteered to go up, and I did. I've been climbing ropes on a farm and trees since I was a pup. I immediately swung out a rope, turned my hands around, flipped my legs over the rope, said, "Okay, guys, pay attention. This is how it's done." I skinnied across it, reached down and waved to the guy standing in the mud beneath me who was glaring at me with evil, and finished the crossing of the rope, took a deep bow, showed everybody how it was done. Thereupon, the rest of my company crossed the rope, and no one ever fell in the mud again, and the black guy hated my guts for the rest of our tour in boot camp. Next story. About 10 weeks in, we go to the rifle range. This is like August, September. We go to the rifle range, and there's this smoky bear hat, master gunnery sergeant, who's been in the Marine Corps since sailing days. He knew that he was the god of the rifle range, and he made it very clear that that was his effing rifle range, and we dare not mess around with him. Now, for some reason, and we were using the M1. The M1 from World War II, 30 caliber, 8-shot clip, and the targets were 300 yards, and they were 10-inch bulls. We were given 2 shots. If you got a Maggie's Drawers, the red flag on 2 shots, you did not get to shoot your 28 shots. For some reason, he made the statement, and nobody shoots down my Maggie's Drawers. It hit my head, how in the hell did anybody ever hit a 2-inch stick waving a flag at 300 yards? And then I thought about it, and I wiggled my arm back and forth and realized, if you shoot right at the base of the stick, that's not moving. The rest of it is. And I said, shit, this is an impossible shot. 300 yards. M1. I asked the gunny if his rifles were zeroed in at 300. And he said, "Sailor, if you can hit it, it's there. It's zeroed at 300. I said, "Okay." So I fired my first shot somewhere toward Lake Michigan. And the next thing I know, there's this Maggie Drawers wavering. I studied up, put the sights right where I want them, squeezed my round, and literally did blow that 2-inch stick away at 300 yards. Best shot I've ever made in my life. The Maggie's Drawers went flying, and the next thing I know, I got 2 shiny combat boots. We're shooting prone position in front of my face, and I am being called everything but a white child. This gunny sergeant went bloody ballistic, and I could do nothing but grin at him because I knew I just made the best shot of my life. And after screaming and yelling at me for about 5 minutes, he finally looked down at me and said, "Sailor, can you shoot?" "Yeah, gunny sergeant, sir, I can shoot. Here's your damn clips, and I better get some bulls because I'm going to be watching your ass." And he stood over me as I did my shoot. Out of 28 rounds, I can sit and tell you to this day, 27 bulls and 1 on the edge. Whereupon gunny sergeant, sir, said, "Sailor, you should have joined the Marine Corps." I looked at him and said, "Gunny Sergeant, sir, I was dumb enough to join the fucking Navy. I wasn't dumb enough to join the fucking Marines. Sailor, get the fuck off my range." The nice thing about this story is despite the fact that Gunny Sergeant got madder than hell at me, jumped up and down and called me names, 3 times he called me Sailor. The gunny sergeant assumed at that point I would graduate and I was a sailor. Coming from a Marine, not a bad compliment. Okay, boot camp over. October, go home. Now, we had found out somewhere during our course, I found out that I was an HSSR, and I asked my company commander, what in the hell was an HSSR? He said, Burke, that means you're a high school seaman recruit. You can go to Navy schools. What the hell, Chief? I've already been in school for 12 years. I don't need this. You're going to school. We were tested within a few days of being there. 5 weeks later, we went to another main side and turned around and were reviewed by personnel clerks. I was offered corpsman. I turned it down. I was not going to run down around a battlefield with the Marines with a bullseye on my helmet and no weapon. Two, I was offered dental hygiene dentist assistant. I turned that down. I got bad breath. I don't want yours. Three, the guy looked at me and said, and I looked at him and said, didn't I do good at anything? He said, Burke, you did real good on the radio test. You could be a radioman. Last year in high school, I took a course in electronics and flunked it cold. Course in typing, I passed with a D. My electronics instructor had been a World War II GI biller and said, if any of you idiots join the military when you graduate and anybody's ever dumb enough to offer you any electronics, jump on it. So when this guy said radioman, I said, done. When I graduated from boot camp, 15 days of boot camp leave, orders to Bainbridge, Maryland, Naval Training Center, which was a World War II leftover base just 100 miles from my home since I lived in Delaware, for radioman A school, 26 weeks. I arrived there in November of 61, graduated in June of 62, 26-week course. I got set back 4 weeks because I got had trouble with amplifiers and had to repeat the course and graduated with a I started out in class 1162 and graduated with class 1362 in June of 62. Orders from radio school. Oh, by the way, radio school. The only thing I can say about radio school is this. On several occasions, an instructor in radio school would make a point about electronics or electrical or radio, and suddenly it would dawn on me that what Mr. Haight had been trying to teach me a year before in high school, all of a sudden it stuck. The light came on, and I realized what Mr. Haight was trying to teach to me, and his class had been invaluable because it was my first introduction to a whole new world of electronics and new language and whatever and new math values. So Mr. Haight's class was invaluable. Any number of times during radio school, the light would come on. Oh, shit, that's what Mr. Haight was talking about. And that's what I can say about radio school. Orders from radio school. NAF, Naha, Okinawa. Now, just before we got orders in Bainbridge, Maryland, I had made the statement, you know what? If they're going to give us orders 1,000 miles from home and I can just barely make it back on a weekend, I'd rather get orders 10,000 miles from home so I don't get killed on I-95 trying to make a long weekend. Naval Air Facility, Naha, Okinawa, I was not going to be coming home for a while. 18-month tour, preferred sea duty, arrived there in July of 1962, left there in late February. 1964, Okinawa was heaven. As a high school senior, and while I was in radio school, I had been a skin and scuba diver. In the Navy, I'd already purchased tanks, wetsuit, and equipment. Because airlines did not weigh sea bags, I had mailed almost all of my uniforms to my new address in Naha, Okinawa, carried just a uniform or two to get by, and had taken all my scuba gear in my sea bag. That means tanks, wetsuit, regulator, weight belt, spear gun, dive knife, the whole kitty. Arrive in Naha, Okinawa. Get picked up in a Grey Ghost bus at Kadena. Bus down to Naha. Spent the night in a World War II Quonset hut. chief petty officer in charge, master at arms. The next morning after breakfast, he decided, since we were all kids out of tech schools, to give us a junk on the bunk and a sea bag inspection. Ha! I laid out my two pairs of socks, one pair of skivvies, one shirt, one this, and tanks, regular weight belt, etc. Chief saw this and said, "Sailor, where in the hell are your uniforms?" And I said, "Chief, if I'm lucky and you're lucky, they're at the post office waiting for me to pick them up. If I'm not lucky and you're not lucky, they're at small stores waiting for me to buy new ones. Sailor, what the fuck do you think you're going to do here?" I said, "Chief, I have no idea what you do here, but me, I'm going diving." I joined the Naha Carl Kings Air Force Dive Club and did approximately 50 dives in Okinawa. And those dives were between 45 and 150 feet. One little story here. My lieutenant commander, my comm officer, lieutenant commander by the name of Pederis, I found out I needed permission from the Navy to join the scuba club. Pederis called me in, sat me down, and asked me a question. If I would dive on his ship, if he asked me to, if there was a line fouled around a propeller. And I said, "Sure, why not?" He immediately then pounced like a big cat and said, "But you're never supposed to dive without a dive partner." I said, "That's right." And I said, "If you're the captain of the ship, sir, I wouldn't think you'd be dumb enough to send me down without a dive partner." That did not make him happy. He then said, "You know, if you get hurt, I can court-martial you. You're U.S. government property." I said, "Mr. Pederis, if I get hurt scuba diving, the odds are I drowned. If you want to court-martial my rotting, smelly body after it surfaces and washes ashore in about 5 days, have at it. I don't think I'll be worried much." He then told me to get out of his office, and I had a good year and a half dive in Okinawa. Is this the kind of stuff you want?
Sure.
Okay. Okinawa, left there, Feb 64, back home, freezed my ass off for about 15 days in Delaware, colder than a witch. Went and caught my ship, and I picked her up in Long Beach. She was in for a yard period, her first one since the West Coast. Met my new chief, etc., etc., and I was a wise ass. He knew it. We didn't get along that great. And the first day we went to sea, going to sea from Long Beach. One, we were in dry dock. I reported aboard as an RNSN. I was still E3. I took my test while we were in dry dock for third class, and I actually got it in June of 64. But when we left dry dock, I was still in E3. When you go into dry dock, a Navy ship unloads. When it comes out of dry dock, it reloads. What do I mean? Provisions and ammo. Aboard our ship, we had 8 3-inch 50 anti-aircraft guns in 4 tubs, one on each corner of 2 each. We loaded provisions first. I was on a work party all day, about 10 hours. By the time it was over, a 48-pound case of canned coffee weighed the same as a 17-pound case of dehydrated potatoes. Your arms were aching, your shoulders were aching, your legs and calves were dead. When those of us of the crew who loaded that night went to bed, nobody moved a muscle. We were dead. Next day, we loaded ammo. 60-pound, 3-inch 50 shells I loaded for God knows anywhere from 8 to 10 hours. We loaded thousands of rounds. And believe me, again, hard work, hard, hard work. We also then went down to Point Loma where degaussing cables were passed under the ship to demagnetize us. Another back-breaking job. If you don't have to, you don't want to be aboard a ship and do yard periods. Bad stuff. Then I became a petty officer in June 1964, and we did a midshipman cruise to Vancouver, British Columbia. Spent about 5 days up there. Canadian girls, they have a cold country, but they are very warm-blooded. Had a ball up there. Went back up in the fall of 64 before we left for Westpac and spent a month. Me and two other guys went up, and the attraction was the same. Babes. Okay. During the summer and early fall of 1964, the USS Vancouver was involved in three amphibious assault landings in a Camp Pendleton area. I claim the fame that I've assaulted the United States coast as many times as I assaulted Vietnam, three times each. And didn't shoot anybody. Either time. August of 1964, we were prepping to go to Westpac in November. Now, in the spring of 64, we got our entire itinerary for the entire Westpac cruise pouched to us in message pouch form. We all read it. We all knew what we were supposed to be doing for the next 6 months once we went to Westpac. Here's a point I want the interviewers to get clearly understood. August of 1964, Gulf of Tonkin took place. That changed everything in the Pacific. October 64, before we departed, a crew of yard workers came on board and installed in our radio shack brand new KW-7s. The reason for this was that the Turner Joint and Maddox, when they were attacked off Gulf Coast, had to use old one-time pad five-letter group encryption and Morse code speed keys. All radio ops have to be Morse code operators. I am a Morse code operator. And back in Washington, they found this communication is too slow, too cumbersome, and there was a new piece of equipment known as the KW-7 had been out since the night 61-62. And it was installed from then on forward on every ship headed for Westpac. We got four of them installed. And the morning we left for Westpac, Gulf of Tonkin crisis, 64 was an election year. Barry S. Goldwater was running for president. Barry S. Goldwater made the statement that he would bomb the North Vietnamese to the Stone Age if necessary to save American lives. Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was then president since the death of Kennedy, said that Barry S. Goldwater was a warmonger. Lyndon Baines Johnson won the election in November of 1964. Here's the point. The USS Vancouver left to go deployed 16th through the 18th November, and our entire overseas itinerary had already been changed. We left the morning of the 18th or 16th, I believe. We went out to sea over the horizon and then straight north up the California coast. We came in at midnight at a place called Port Hueneme, about 180 miles up the California coast. We came in the dark. It's a very small port. Our ship could barely get turned around. Reason why I know all this is I was on the bridge. I was a member of the tug and sea detail. What happened? We loaded a battalion of Marines called the 1st LAMBAM. There was the 1st Light Anti-Aircraft Missile Battalion. They were equipped with Hawk anti-aircraft missiles. It was proposed that they would be deployed around Da Nang. We had secret orders to load these guys, and we had to be over the horizon before sunup. We loaded, I was on the bridge all night long. We loaded these guys from midnight to 4 in the morning, fast as we could. All the phone lines have been cut. These guys in the 1st LAMBAM have been told that they were going away for a weekend maneuver. They were home ported out 29 palms. We left before dawn. The next morning, we were over the horizon, out of sight by sunrise. Our destination was a point in the ocean which I found out later because I was able to talk to the navigators and get the latitude and longitude, off about 150 miles off the coast of Okinawa. There we met an oiler. Now, point I'd like to make, almost every ship that ever goes to Westpac stops at Pearl Harbor on the way over and stops at Pearl Harbor on the way back. On my first Westpac and only Westpac cruise on the USS Vancouver, we neither stopped in Pearl Harbor on the way out, or did we stop at Pearl Harbor on the way back. We didn't. We sailed on the way over. We got to this point. We were met by an oiler. We refueled, and it was then decided that we would land the first land bam in Okinawa. We went back to Okinawa. We unloaded these guys, loaded more troops, and stayed at sea. Now, the reason why I bring all this up is the point that Lyndon Johnson had labeled Barry Goldwater a warmonger during the election year. As soon as the ink was dry on the ballots, the whole Pacific operation changed. And we were already taking troops as soon as we left in November, just days after the election, to start reinforcing in the Pacific. And that is a fact because I was there. I will never, ever trust politicians. I've learned the hard way. And after we picked up the guys, dumped the guys in Okinawa, had a few days liberty, we picked up a battalion of grunts out of the 3rd MARDIV, and we spent the next few months either off the coast of Vietnam or around Subic Bay in the South Pacific area. Christmas, 1964. We saw Bob Hope. Oh, by the way, I actually saw Bob Hope three times in my life. 62, 63 Okinawa, 62 in Okinawa, 64 in Subic, 1987 at Clark Air Base when I was there with the CIA. And I consider that one of the high points of my life. After all, if you ever saw Bob Hope, you were out there where it was happening. That's where he went. And I saw that wonderful man three times, and I want everybody to know that. He was great. Troops loved him. He could have got elected president any day of the week. Now then, Christmas 64. Viet Cong people blew up the Brinks Hotel, which is a BOQ in Saigon, killed a bunch of officers and wounded a bunch. At that point, our ship and the rest of Fibron 1 was in Subic. We went on 30-minute reaction time to go to sea. We moved out and moored at a buoy out in the harbor instead of being at a pier. I, actually being a member of the tug and sea detail, actually ate my Christmas dinner of 1964 on the bridge out of a cold tray. What we did is everybody in bridge and sea detail went down, got their turkey dinner, took it right back to the bridge, and ate on the bridge. I will never forget that Christmas dinner because we were on men's notice to head for sea with our battalion of Marines embarked. We then, in early February, wound up down off the coast of Vietnam over the horizon, and we stayed. Day after day, cruising at 5 to 6 knots, the three ships, Union, Henrico, Vancouver, accompanied by an old destroyer, the USS Boyd, as our gunfighter. Day in and day out of just monotonous sitting there, the Marines turned around, did exercises and all kinds of drills and firing drills and stuff to keep them busy, and everybody got bored like hell. About 30 days into this deal, I was scanning messages every night. I was a petty officer to watch. I made several mistakes in 48 hours. The chief called me down on it and says, "Burke, what's the problem?" I said, "Chief, I haven't had a cold beer. I haven't had a piece of ass. I haven't felt sand under my feet in a month. I'm going nuts." And he said, "Well, tell you what. We got a call from the Boyd. They're shorthanded people, and they asked for about six guys to come over and find out what it's like in the destroyer cruiser Pacific." He said, "How would you like to get highlined over the Boyd for about 6 days and get a break?" I said, "Shit, yeah, why not?" So I got highlined along with a couple other enlisted and a couple of officers over to the USS Boyd. which was built in 1943, an old Fletcher-class destroyer. I spent a week aboard her, got highlined back to my ship, and about two or three nights later, we're now at day 42 or so off the coast, I get one of my favorite claims of fame, and that is that I started the Vietnam War. How is that? I was the petty officer on duty from midnight to 7 in the morning, the night that we actually received the immediate message that said, land the landing force. And my humble contention is that me and two other Radiman petty officers, one on the Henrico and one on the Union, started the Vietnam War because we were the first guys to receive the message that said, put the Marines on the beach. We're now putting in combat troops. Here's the fun part about this message. Immediate, 3 o'clock in the morning, wake the captain up. This is a teletype message. Came in 100-word-a-minute teletype. No tape. Right in the middle, right dead flat center, in H-hour, D-day, and all those time frames, the damn thing missed a line feed and overlined. Now, this happened. It was not an unknown occurrence. It happened every so often. It was a routine occurrence. We had a magnifying glass, a legal pad, ballpoint pens, and the Raymond's job was to sit down and go character by character and break out by ink, by pen and ink, this overline. As soon as I saw this message, I knew this was the hot one we'd been waiting for. My runner was Willie Wilson, a fellow Raymond who was junior to me. Willie Wilson was one of the true heroes of Vietnam because he was also assigned to the boats. He made every mission he was asked to make, and he was scared sick. Why? Because little Willie was 6'5", 285 pounds, a black guy. He was the biggest man I've ever seen in my life, and he was my runner. I sent him for the skipper. Skipper gets up there a couple minutes later. Shower shoes, khakis, T-shirt, and no hat. Skipper is J.C. Stock, Captain J.C. Stock, greatest skipper in the world. We'd all follow him to hell in a handbasket. This guy was a sailor, and he believed in the Navy Marine team. And at sea, he wore a Marine fatigue cap with his officer's crest on it to symbol the commitment of the U.S. Navy and the Marine team. Captain Stock came into the main radio that night, comes in the back where I am, in the back room, and I'm sitting here breaking out this message. He's standing over my shoulder. Not the best of situations. I looked up at him and said, Skipper, I got fresh coffee out in main radio. Captain Stock looked at me and says, Burke, is it bothering you that I stand over your shoulder? I said, yes, Skipper, it is. He said, Burke, I'm going to go get a cigarette and a cup of coffee main radio. Call me when you got it. I whereupon completed breaking it out and said, Skipper, we got it. And he came, got complete message, thanked me, and left. And that's how we received the message on the night, somewhere around March the 2nd through the 4th, to land the landing force, because we got the message 2 to 4 days before we actually put them in. Next morning, I got off my mid-shift and went to bed. And I no sooner got breakfast and hit the rack, and I get woken up and told there's an all-hands meeting by the chief and Lieutenant Emery, our comm officer, up in main radio. I go up to main radio. Everybody in there is white as a sheet, and no one's talking. Everybody's pale as a ghost. And I'm trying to figure out, like, what in the hell? I said, Chief, what the hell did you get me out of bed for? Burke, we're drawing straws to see who takes the first fast boat into the beach. He said, you know, we got the message last night to turn on land the landing force. I said, yeah, I got it. Is this news? He said, we're drawing straws for this first landing boat. I said, give me the straws. He handed me a handful of matchsticks, and there was a short one. I threw them in the trash can and said, this is bullshit. I said, that first landing boat is mine. I said, point one, I've been in the boats and training longer than anybody. Point two, I can swim better than anybody on this ship. which was demonstrated when we had swim call here recently and half of these guys almost drowned. Point three, I shot an orange crate in half when we did rifle practice the other day, and half of these guys can't even hit the ship, let alone an orange crate. I said, so that first landing is mine. And I looked around and saw a look of relief on everybody's face and said, if there's nothing else, can I go back to bed? She said, yeah, get the hell out of here. So I left. And I suddenly walked out the door, realized that I just had volunteered to maybe get shot at. And maybe I just done something stupid, but it was too late to worry about it. And I said, the hell with it, went to bed. A few days later, we put them on the beach. Morning of the landing, at about 4 in the morning, boat crews and the Marines and the landing teams were called to the mess decks for early breakfast. Typical landing breakfast of steak and eggs. I'm walking through the breakfast line, getting my chow, and pointed to little Willie, who's also in the boat crews, and he was going to be on the other boat. Willie, check these suckers out. He said, what? I said, look at the goddamn Marines. He said, what about them? Look at the boots. Now, here's the deal. These grunts have been aboard our ship for the last 40-some days. They haven't picked up anything anywheres. They haven't been on liberty. So what am I talking about? And the boots of these boondockers, of these grunts, were straight razors, switchblades, Bowie knives. One guy was wearing a chest rig with a .357 Black Hawk Magnum. Another guy had a .38 and a shoulder holster. They were carrying Bowie knives on their hips. These guys had enough illegal hardware to start a blacksmith shop. These guys could start their own gun store. These guys had this crap in their sea bags and in their packs for the whole time. These guys, these grunts, these guys were not draftees. These were all volunteers like us. This is 64, 65. These guys are legitimate badasses. And once I saw these guys, I knew damn well I didn't want to run into any of those Marines in a dark alley. But these guys were ready for war. And that is something I noticed on the first morning. Now, they loaded up in their Amtraks. They swam out our back hatch. They loaded up a couple of Big Mike 8s and landed these guys. And the landing, for all intents and purposes, for the Marines, was over in an hour and a half, 2 hours. And the ship had quieted down. Because the last 2 days, troop ops had been open. The Marines had set up their radios. I mean, after I woke up from the day after I got the landing message, the whole ship was a beehive activity where everybody was prepping equipment and getting ready because it was going to be the real deal. And the last 48 hours before they went in, the ship had been crazy. Now, after the Marines were gone, everything got quiet except for this. The Marines go on the beach and they're landed inside of an hour flat with their Amtraks and all that crap. We, the U.S. Navy on the amphib ships, are working around the clock for the next 96 hours because when a BLT lands, a battalion landing team of 950 Marines, between 900 and 950 Marines, they go with a battery of guns, some tanks, fuel trucks, six spies, and 60 days of everything. Grenades, bullets, beans, butter, sea rats. They go with 60 days of ration on the beach. And for the next 4 days, we were working around the clock, taking this stuff in landing craft upriver and landing at landing ramps and dropping this stuff off. And when we went to sea, especially me and those the rest of us who were serving in the boats, were some tired-ass puppies because we averaged about 2 to 4 hours of sleep a day because we were working round-the-clock ops. Landing the troops on the beach, landing the supplies out of the landing craft was suspended at sunset. However, if you were in a fast boat crew, your job did not end at sunset. You then spent the rest of the night either circling the ship on anti-swimmer patrol or doing 5 miles an hour in Da Nang River, no lights, no nav aids, no radar, during anti-boat patrol to keep the little boys in black pajamas and their sandpans from crossing over the river and screwing with the Marines. Some scary shit. And every night, I took every one of the night patrols in Da Nang River, and every night, I thank God when the horizon got dawn and I knew I'd made it through another night. On several night patrols, we saw tracers flying around the ground nearby within hundreds of yards of us where the Marines were being probed by the boys in black pajamas. So although never got shot at, never took any hits, we knew that the bad guys were out there. Okay? Let me take a time out.
After the tape starts.
Wave a finger at me. Okay. In the process, we landed the first battalion of Marines was the 3rd Battalion. 9th Marines was landed between 8 March and 12 March in 1965. Thereafter, we left, went back to Okinawa, picked up more, brought them back. Before it was over, we made 3 landings between March and April. We made 3 landings in Vietnam, Da Nang twice and Hue once. Okay? Vietnam stories. Before we landed the troops, we had boat crews were called away one day for rifle practice on the fantail. The gunner's mates had streamed orange crates on each side, and these orange crates were on a line about 80 yards back. And there is a thing with Navy crews. There's called the left-hand rates and the right-arm rates, and the deck rates are called the left-arm rates or whatever. And these guys are the ones who think they're real sailors, and they're the navigators, the boatswain mates, and the gunner's mates. They're the real Navy. Those of us in operations, the radiomen, the sonarmen, the ETs, guys like that, we were the pussy rates. We were the candy asses because we had air-conditioned quarters, and we worked inside and all this other good stuff. So when I went out there to do rifle practice, this second-class gunner's mate handed me this carbine and said I was going to get 2 clips, 2 15-round clips. And said, going to show us how to do it, Sparks? I looked at him and said, we'll see, guns. I knew something. He didn't. So when I got my chance, I fired the first round out of my M1 carbine and picked my target. I did not shoot at the crate. I didn't even shoot at the slat of the crate. I picked a knot hole in one of the slats, and my gun fired 2 inches high and 2 inches left. So I knew where Sweetheart was shooting. Because unbeknownst to guns, I'd had an uncle. And he had served in Korea in the 50s and had somehow smuggled home an M1 carbine. He used to come down to our farm. And between the ages of my age of 12 and 16, I had fired several hundred rounds through an M1 carbine. And I could shoot that little sucker real sweet. I proceeded with my 15-round clip to cut every slat in that crate and turn that crate into a handful of splinters. He brought it in, streamed a new crate, and I said, guns, how about my second clip? Burke, get the fuck off my catwalk. I got 1 clip only. That's what you get for showing off. Okay, Vietnam story. First landing. One day, we escorted about 7 landing craft about 3 miles up to a landing ramp where they were unloading the cargo. There was a beach jumper unit ashore that had forklifts and stuff and was unloading all the sea rats and all that equipment. Oh, by the way, those of us who did night patrols in the river, the last at sunset when we took up the last flotilla of landing craft, we always went aside one of those landing craft and asked them if they were carrying rations. And we stole a case of rations off them every night, so we had hot rations because we used to turn around and use our P-38 can openers, open the rat tops up of the rations and warm them up on a diesel engine exhaust manifold and had hot rations. It beat the Lipton soup they had on the ship. So we had hot sea rats every night in the river. Okay. On this particular day, we turned around, took up a flotilla of landing craft, took them to the ramp. We pulled down about 300 yards and we tied up our fast boat to a pier. All the crew dumped their weapons in the back stern sheets, with my exception. Now, no one carried a load. The officer carried a .45 Thompson and a .45 caliber pistol. The rest of us carried, the coxswain carried a .45. The rest of us carried M1 carbines. Whenever I got on the boat, my radio speakers were right in front of the cabin, right beside the coxswain. I would lay my M1 carbine to my right, undo a pouch, put in a full clip in my weapon, pull the bolt back, and there's a little pin on a 30 caliber carbine on the sear on the receiver. You push on the bolt. You push that pin down, and it locks the bolt open. I then pushed off the safety this way, and then laid my carbine down on the deck beside me on the top of the cabin. This way, in the event of an emergency, all I had to do is snatch my carbine, slam the bolt, and I had a hot weapon in half a millisec. My left hand, I always laid my 35 millimeter single lens reflex camera so I could take pictures. This day in question, the guys got off the boat, left their weapons in the back, got up, and were taking pictures of all the kids on the pier, and were handing out candy, yada, yada, yada. I was facing forward, enjoying the sun and resting my arms and looking at the river. The first warning I had that something was amiss was the officer on the dock yelled, "Burke, he's got the Thompson." And I knew that I was dead, because the Thompson had three tape magazines laying beside it. I snatched my weapon, spun around, slammed the bolt shut, and faced a Vietnamese kid on our boat with a Thompson in one hand and three tape mags in the other. I made a decision that I had him called. And we stared at each other for what seemed like eternity, and I'm sure it was no longer than a half a dozen seconds. I then start waving the muzzle of my carbine toward the deck. He kept his hands apart, laid the weapon on the deck and the mags. I then start waving the muzzle of my weapon to get off the boat, and he got off the boat. To this day, I'm reasonably certain that I let a VC escape. But by the same token, I do not live with the memory that I killed an innocent teenager. There was no way of knowing. But how did he get aboard that boat without anybody seeing him? How did he know? Because the carbines were laying in the back, but the guys were wearing belts with clips in their belts. There was no ammunition for any gun on that boat except me with my carbine and the three tape mags for that .45. That .45 Thompson was the only weapon on the boat with ready ammunition. And how did he know that that's what he wanted? Oh, this kid knew what he was hunting for. And I let a VC go. I'm almost certain of it to this day. But that's life. Next story. That's Vietnam story. We'll skip and go on.
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Okay, 5 minutes. The Vancouver, the Union, and Rico left the Vietnam area late April, stopped in Subic Bay. We did a one-night stop because there the Vancouver separated from the rest of the squadron. Because we were a new amphib ship, we had an invitation to go to Australia for the Coral Sea Cruise. For those who are not savvy to this situation, in 1942, the United States Navy Task Group saved northern Australia from an invasion by the Japanese. The Australians are one of the only allies we have in the world who's never forgotten we saved their ass. Every year, U.S. Navy ships are invited to go down by selection to Coral Sea Cruise. We went to the Coral Sea Cruise, and in that ensuing trip, we crossed the equator, and although I only did a 4-year hitch in the Navy, I am a shellback. I crossed the equator on a ship of war. I've got the certificates and got the bruises to prove it. We got to Sydney. If you couldn't get laid in Sydney, cut it off and throw it away because you don't deserve to have it. The easiest way to meet a chick in Sydney during the 7 days we were there is to stay on the ship in your dress blues with your Liberty card in your pocket, because every day at 1 o'clock we opened the ship up for visitors and they came aboard in droves. Every flavor from vanilla to light chocolate, anything you wanted came on board. I picked up a Polish blonde, stacked, packed, and racked, and had a great day for seven straight time for 7 days. When our ship went back to sea out of Sydney, everybody on tug and sea detail, every officer, every enlisted man on the bridge was wearing sunglasses because we left at about 8 in the morning, and everybody was still drunk, hungover. We went back to sea to get some sleep. Sydney was a hell of a liberty. Then we went down to Melbourne, spent a week there, and headed back home. On the way back home, by the way, Melbourne was not nearly as much fun as Sydney. Melbourne, Australia at that time had just decided to send troops to Vietnam, and their country was like ours, split down the middle, and the leftist tugboat union in Melbourne refused to moor our ship, and we found out about this just as we were leaving the harbor in Sydney. And I actually told our skipper, screw Melbourne, let's turn this thing around and go back to Sydney. The skipper said, Burke, I'd love to, but orders are orders. And I said, shit. And we went to Melbourne. From Melbourne, we went to, we picked up 80 cases of Australian beer, and we stopped in Samoa, American Samoa, Pago Pago, for 2 days to load fuel. And then we steamed straight from Pago Pago all the way back to the States. And as I said, our ship made a Westpac cruise and never stopped at Pearl Harbor either, going over or coming back. And it's the first I've ever heard of such a thing, but we did it. In Pago Pago for 2 days, I went on the first beach party. I took my skin diving gear. We had a great big beach party, plenty of beer. The cook supplied food, baked beans, potatoes, chicken, hamburgers, hot dogs, the whole schmear. And I took my skin diving gear and swam in a lagoon for about an hour and a half. Came back, shucked my gear, climbed a coconut palm, skinned the hell out of myself, was bleeding all over the place from rough bark in that coconut palm, but I got a coconut to take home my mom and dad. Whereupon I gave my skin diving gear, swims fast and mortal, to the rest of the guys in my division, radarmen, radiomen, stuff, and told them, you're welcome to borrow my gear. Do not, I repeat, do not go in water over chest deep. I've just spent an hour and a half out there in the nastiest goddamn riptides I've ever ran into in my entire life. And it was true. I went and got food, had some beer, totally wasted. About an hour and a half later, two idiots from our ship had gotten stranded out on the reef, called for help. Everybody was half drunk. Everybody wanted to be a hero. Three men on our ship drowned that day. My point, we went through three landings in Vietnam and never lost a single guy. Now, a single injury, but we lost three guys on the beach party because of gross stupidity. The officers who were there did not take command. Everybody was drunk. Everybody wanted to be a hero, and idiots died. I refused to go in the water and stayed on the beach, and I was actually begged by a guy named Stan Freeberg, a signalman first class in my division, to go with him because he knew that I was a skilled diver, and I told him, Stan, if you go out there, you will not come back. And I refused to go because I was bleeding all over and did not want to become shark bait, and I knew I had a gut full of food and booze, and it was not the time to go out there. And three people died that day, and I stayed on the beach. And to this day, I will never forget that memory, that there was nothing I could do. And they died because of stupidity and foolishness. And the investigation later showed that. We got back in June to the States, late June. I was discharged the 23rd of July of 1965. Flew home, took off the uniform, and 10 months later was picked up by the CIA. I spent 27 years as a CIA communications officer. As I sit today with these interviewers, I can tell the world between the Navy and the CIA, I was in 25 countries and spent most of my adult life overseas. One of the questions I've been asked to address is, how did I wind up in Fernandina Beach, Florida? Here's how. My last overseas tour was at Clark Airfield in the Philippines between 86 and 89. I was a single dad raising a son. He had trouble in school. I bought some National Geo maps, and on those maps, I sat there during several months and would look at them, and I decided when I wanted to retire, I was not scraping windows anymore. I was not shoveling snow anymore, and I wanted to be within 30 minutes of a saltwater launch ramp. On the map, the National Geo map, there's a campfire on Fernandina Beach on the Amelia Island. That campfire is symbolized by Fort Clinch. It's a campground. I camped down here in March of 1990 with a Philippine girlfriend who came from overseas to visit me. We spent a week here. I came back in December of 90 for Christmas with my son. We spent another week here, and during both weeks, we looked around at the island, and I said, this will work. And during the December of 1990 visit, I got in touch with real estate agents, stayed in touch with them, got brochures for the next 3 years. When I retired in July 31st of 1993, I had already been down here in June, in early July of 93, had already had a contract on a house. We immediately moved from Virginia down here. We were down here the day after my retirement. I have been here for the last 14 years. I believe it's a wonderful place to live. Like everybody else, I'm happy to see more and more people moving here, but I love it, and I will die here, hopefully no time soon. Thank you much for the interview.
Well, thank you very much. We want to thank you for sharing your recollections with us and for service to the country. This concludes the interview with William C. Burke.